if any aggregator of my client came up and first offered that and my client came to me with what advice would I tell them, I would say, no. I want all my money right now.
Thanks for subscribing to the ZonCon podcast, the podcast all about Amazon conversations. These are the tips and tricks to become an Amazon millionaire. Here is your host, Andrew Erickson. He is all things Amazon, and so is this podcast. Let's have an Amazon conversation.
Hey guys, Andrew Erickson back for part two of our e-commerce accounting tips and tricks. I am here with the CEO of Avast USA. That is Tim Nelson. Tim, thank you so much for being here again.
Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Yeah, if you guys did not catch the first part, this is, as you heard me say, this is the second part in our two-part series. The first part was published last week. We talked about some of the day-to-day tips and tricks on how to run your business day-to-day, and some of the misconceptions on how to form a corporation, what to do if you are a US-based versus foreign-based company, and how the top mistakes that people run into on how Amazon reports your taxes versus how you should be reporting your taxes. And then we also had a little discussion on inventory and the ins and outs of doing that. So it's a great all-around like tips and tricks on your day-to-day accounting. Today, I wanted to focus on some of the bigger stuff. Instead of like filling out the little bookkeeping stuff and the little small stuff like that, I wanted to think about like bigger, more kind of advanced techniques of taxes. And I have a few things I'm trying to work on that I'm hoping Tim can help us with. And then we're also going to talk about what happens, what do our taxes look like if we do an exit? We build our company up to that point. We spend the 3, 5, 10 years to build our business up. We get that big windfall, and then the government takes like almost all of it. How do we prevent that, right? Or the ins and outs of it. So Tim, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you give us a little bit more of an intro on yourself and Avast, and then we'll jump right into it.
Sure. Again, Tim Nelson, I'm a CEO of Avast USA, and I'm a certified public accountant. Avast is the global e-commerce accounting firm. We are headquartered in the UK, but we have offices here in the United States, along with France, Germany, Italy, and China. And really, we look to help e-commerce sellers throughout the world with their taxes and compliance so that they can just sell.
You're like in all the cool spots. You should also open up a branch in like Hawaii and Cancun. And you're like, you're
covered. I know.
Bali. Yeah. That's like all the best places.
It's funny. We'd all just then migrate down there. Yep. I need to visit that office. You know, I'm sure I'm needed for something.
Oh, that's great. Cool. So, okay. I had two questions that I've been playing with, and I'm curious if you can help me with these.
Sure.
So I've been talking to a bunch of people about the R&D tax credit, research and design. Do you know much about the R&D tax credit?
Yes, especially when it comes to, let's say, you know, you're trying out new inventory, you're trying out a new product, and what, you know, it's great when you try them out, and let's say it doesn't work, or it even does work. Is there any credits for doing something like that? And yes, there's the R&D, as we call it, the R&D credit. And so a lot of our clients talk about that, and especially if they're putting new products out there, which quite a few of them do. And there are tax advantages to having that.
So if we're just a regular boring Amazon company, again, $1 million, $2 million in annual revenue, 20% margins, we're just gonna run with those numbers, right?
Yep.
Most of these things kind of scale up, double or half it or double it, whatever. So we'll just kind of focus on that million just to make the math easy. Million top line, 200,000 profit, right? The R&D tax credit, my understanding is that we are companies that are researching, doing product selection and product development, and we are sourcing these products in China, which is the my understanding, that's the development part, right? We do work with factories, right? And a lot of stuff we do is all custom. Some of it is more custom than other things, but we do a lot of this. We spend a lot of time and energy researching products and developing them. Can I say a blanket statement? 90% of all Amazon sellers would qualify for the R&D tax credit?
Probably, yes. Because, again, there are those, especially to the million, 2 million, some some sellers have their staple goods that are, you know, they have their brand set and they're good and they've got their product and they're selling. And it's just now down to marketing and expansion throughout the globe to increase their sales. So let's say they're not trying new products out. And so maybe R&D isn't for them. But yeah, 90% of the sellers are always constantly trying new products, always trying new things, changing things up. And so, yes, I would say that, yeah, the R&D tax credit would or should apply to them.
But you only get to deduct corporate taxes, right?
Correct. Right. So, you
know, so if you're an S corp, it doesn't really help much.
Right. Because, and which again, if you watched the last video, is what would be my recommendation for everybody is to be an S corporation. It wouldn't help much again if your corporation's a loss, because again, that number flows to your personal return. But if the corporation is showing a profit, that credit should it help with your taxes.
So can we set up a C corp, get rid of the double taxation by, you know, doing enough research and design to get rid of the C corp double taxation, and then we get the benefit of retained earnings and retained inventory and all that other cool stuff that you do get with a C corp? Can we do that?
I would say probably no. Only because if your profits get to a nice sizable amount, let's say 400,000, your credit's not going to be as great as that. So you're going to owe your corporation, you're going to pay corporation taxes on a C corporation. That's about 20, 21%. Okay, you paid that tax. And great, let's say you even add some credit. But now you as a person want that money out of that corporation. Now you're going to take it out through payroll, where you're going to pay payroll taxes. So now you've paid tax on that money again. Or you're going to take a dividend out of that corporation, which now is dividend income on your personal tax return. So you're paying taxes again. You just can't get around that double taxation. It's that aggressive thinking and outside the box, which is great, because again, talking to sellers is just the best way to learn things, or what's going through their mind on what they're looking to do is the best way to learn. And so it's interesting that you looked at it that way. Like, all right, I want to be a C corporation, but want to get around that double taxation. But it's just not going to add up to the right amount of numbers. You're always going to owe more tax.
All right, got it. So the next one. S corp. Can I get rid of the payroll tax on an S corp?
So when you say payroll tax, you're talking about if you take payroll as a owner of an S corporation.
Again, we'll use big numbers just because it makes math easy. And I always say don't do public math, but we're going to $1 million, 200 profit, 50,000 W-2 income. Okay, So I have to pay payroll taxes on that. Can I get rid of the payroll taxes with the R&D tax credit?
You could help limit it with the R&D tax credit. But again, I would turn around and say, don't even take 50,000 in W-2 income. Just get rid of the payroll. Again, this goes back to our last video. But again, I tell the owners of my S corporations, if you're not worried about Social Security, get rid of taking payroll on your S corporation. Just draw the money out when you need it and just make sure you put enough money on the side. You know, the IRS may say, hey, you know, you're supposed to take, again, that reasonable amount of payroll. But as we know, Amazon, for some reasons, just shut down your company. They close things down because of whatever reason they come up with. And, you know, making sure you have that money on the side to help pay for everything else, I think is a good reason why maybe not to take payroll there as well.
Cool. Okay.
But I know you were focusing on that, the R&D tax credit. But again, I get back to payroll taxes and stuff like that. That credit's a good thing to have, but not more important than organizing those other things like C corporation or payroll taxes.
Good. Okay. That's good. Sometimes I get focused on the small things. I get excited about some little loophole. So you're giving me a bit bigger perspective here. Let's chill on the R&D. Let's get the other things structured correctly. So, okay, good. Good. Okay. Here's the next one I have.
Sure.
Billable babies.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
Yes.
So can I hire family members like my children, my dependents, or siblings or whatever, and pay them? Well, they're not making, I guess a sibling wouldn't make sense, but like, I guess a non-working sibling or a child, can I just pay them $12,000 and bill them as a contractor? And then they take their income, and then the baby has to then declare his or her income, but they make less than $12,000. So they pay no taxes because they're poor. And then you get a $12,000 deduction on the business.
So I've had that come up a couple of times and I've advised not to do that. Let's say they're putting their 2-year-old child on payroll, which again, let's say it's out of my league on that. That's advanced tax things. I would never advise anyone to do that, but I hear that a bit. So what there is there's a something called the kiddie tax that happens for parents, meaning, hey, the government doesn't want you to do exactly what you just said there, where let me shift a lot of the income to my kids because they have no income. So maybe I can have them to do $15,000 or $20,000. And, you know, they're going to pay less tax than if it was on my tax return. And so what they do is they've invented this kiddie tax, which kind of works together with your tax so that the tax rate's equal, so that you're not kind of shifting money around. But that happens after a certain level. And usually it's unearned revenue. Like, let's say the kid's a beneficiary in a trust and stuff like that, or there's investments there. And so they're getting dividends and stuff like that. And the government doesn't want you getting around paying taxes as the parent. So they'll do this kiddie tax. But having your child as an employee of your company, it's just something I haven't dealt too much with. And that's a tough one.
Got it. Okay. But I mean, I know if you're selling like back braces or something or garlic presses, it'd be hard to justify that. But if you are selling like a lifestyle brand in the baby niche or toy niche or educational stuff or even like resources for parents, you could justify it.
Sure. Now you're justifying it. That's fine. But let's say, as you said, right, I'm selling dumbbells and, you know, weightlifting stuff. But I'm going to put my 3-year-old on payroll. Yeah, you could maybe put it on a little bit. But as aggressive as I can be, I feel like that's being incredibly aggressive to put your 3-year-old.
Got it.
Put your 12-year-old on? Sure. Absolutely. Everyone can justify a 12-year-old doing some work during the year, stuff like that. 14-year-old, whatever. It's come up a couple of times. Can I put my 1 or 3-year-old on? And it's a tough answer.
Okay. So we have our 12-year-old, and our 12-year-old is properly working. He or she is taping boxes. They're doing returns. They're doing some work, menial work that a 12-year-old can actually accomplish. And they're actually doing, 6 hours every Sunday or something like that. And helping out, and we can pay them like $10,000, and then that would be like a proper expense, and they file their own tax return.
Yeah, absolutely. And odds are they're not going to owe. They may owe a little bit on their tax return because I'm sure you're still claiming that 10-year-old on your return. So yeah, they would file their own tax return and show that $10,000 of income.
Can this child now create retirement accounts like Roth IRAs and stuff?
Yes. So. That's what a lot of people will do, is especially in the 9, 10, 11-year-old range, is even just pay them $5,000 or $6,000, which is around the limit you can contribute to a Roth IRA and stuff like that. Not to get into retirement planning and investing, which is fine, but yes, exactly right, so that they can contribute on behalf of their kid and put that money into a retirement plan. So you start saving for retirement back at 10, 11, 12 years old. The 3-year-old, not too sure, but yeah, 10, 11, that's easily justifiable.
Okay, cool. So now they're self-funding their accounts. Mm-hmm. And this would be a good way, because if you make more than like $180,000 or whatever, you usually don't qualify for Roth IRAs. Right. I know it's like tiered and married and stuff. Let's just say, like, if you're over 200, you definitely can. If you're under 100, you definitely can, right? Roth IRAs.
Correct. But again, I would recommend you over to a financial advisor, because I think it's called like a backdoor Roth IRA contribution, where they have ways of getting around it so that you can still contribute to a Roth IRA, even if you are over certain income limitations. That's my understanding. Again, I'm not a financial advisor, but from what I know, that is still, you're still able to do that.
So I actually did that. I did a backdoor Roth, and I did it myself, and I use Betterment.
Yep, I've heard of them.
Which is the robo-investor thing. We actually have a special deal with Betterment. If you guys want to check that out, you can do a backdoor Roth. We'll put a link in the show notes for that. If you use that Betterment link, you'll buy us a cup of coffee, which we love. I drink a cup of coffee every day, so it'd be fantastic if you guys did that. But Betterment's a great resource. So, okay, cool. I like that. Okay, so now...
Yeah, and as your tax advisor, having a Roth IRA is a great idea, because when you take the money out, you don't pay tax. It's good.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I was so I know you can't pull out the growth on that. So what I was hoping to do is have my children file their own Roth IRAs, and I would that would be effectively my savings account for their university. And so if you put 5, 6, 7, whatever the number is, in every year, then that times 20 would be 100,000. And the principal they can take out and use for the university, but then the growth would be a present to them.
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. So that is something that you can do right now. I know they also have 529 plans that are designed for that. But yeah, it's something that you can speak with your financial advisor about and look to do.
Nice. Okay, cool. The next thing I want to talk about. Okay, so we're going with these big numbers, 200,000, half a million. Let's say our taxable income is $200,000. That's what we're paying taxes on. Mm-hmm. And we go to sell our business, and we spend those, 3, 5, 10 years growing our business, and we sell it for, we'll make a nice easy number to make the math easy, $1 million cash, right? Or $1 million offer, I should say, $1 million offer. Okay, so now, and we get that cash, yay, awesome. Now I have a bunch of money in my pocket. The next year, I'm going to have very little income because my main income source, I just sold, right? So the 3 years leading up to it, I made $200,000. Then I make $1 million. And the next year, I'm expecting to make, let's say less than $100,000. Sure. It's $100,000. You're doing something else, you're making a little bit of money there, right? Yay, awesome, we made $1 million, that's fantastic. Yay, cool, we're so cool and smart, and we're gonna do it again, right? But the tax structure is not set up for this kind of windfall, right? Because generally they're expecting you, I mean, I know that there's even like rules that if your income, the government kind of expects your income is gonna be within 10% every year over year, right?
Correct.
But then you 5X or 10X your income 1 year, and then the next year you like 1/5 your income, right? And you get screwed on your taxes. The government's going to take like half of all that stuff, right? But if you could just like spread it out over the next like a million years, you would pay very little on it. So can you tell us, given this scenario, 200,000 leading up to a million and then going down to, let's say, 50, is there anything special we can do for this exit and plan our taxes around this exit money?
Sure. And I think it really comes down to what type of exit you're going to have. So at Avask, we are heavily involved in mergers and acquisitions, and we work with a lot of different aggregators, but moreover, we work with a lot of sellers to help them sell their company. And with the deals that we've seen, there's two different types really of sales that happen when you sell your business. There's an asset sale, or there's the, selling your company or stock sale. And you're taxed two different ways on each of those types of sales. So if it's an asset sale where the aggregator is coming in and saying, I'm going to give you that $1 million, we just want your inventory and we want the brand and everything like that. Well, really, that's an asset sale, and that's going to be ordinary income, meaning you're going to pay whatever that income is, really kind of your tax rate, what your normal tax rate is, let's say 30%, 35%. And that's going to cost a lot of tax. But then there's the stock sale where you sell the business. And really, it's just like selling a stock. You've been growing the business for between 8 to 10 years. So it's a long-term asset. So really, you're paying probably only 20%. So trying to negotiate with an aggregator or whoever's looking to buy you to get a stock sale is really advantageous to you. Now, most aggregators want to do an asset sale for various reasons, but getting that kind of stock sale will save you on taxes. But let's say the aggregator says, nope, it's going to be an asset sale. We don't want anything to do with your business. We just want the brand and the product and everything like that. So then there's different types of ways that the aggregator may pay you. And one of those ways that would save on tax is if it's kind of like an earnout or a pay scale schedule where I will pay you over 2 years or 3 years or year and a half, where you're not getting all that money up front. And the government will agree with you, okay, you haven't gotten the money yet, so you don't have to pay tax yet. So you're not paying as much tax, even though you spread it out over X amount of time and you're going to kind of eventually pay the tax, but it does definitely limit the amount of tax you're going to get hit with. But if any aggregator of my client came up and first offered that and my client came to me with what advice would I tell them, I would say no. I want all my money right now. That is the best advice I could give to anybody looking to sell their company. You want your cash up front. I don't want a payout, even though it happens a lot. I want as much money as up front. I don't want stock. I don't want anything that is not cash to me right now, because again, you never know what's going to happen in the future. You know, everyone signs an agreement and things are, everyone's all happy, and then they move on, and let's say something happens and they can't pay out the rest of it for whatever reason. Getting as much money up front, to me, is the most important thing. And I don't want stock. I don't want incentives or this or that or anything. Just give me money right here. Okay, yeah, I may have to pay tax on it, but just give me the money. Cash is king. I want the cash.
Nice. I love that. That's good. Yeah, that's good. So I think we had talked on the last episode that we can do all these little tips and tricks to kind of like optimize our taxes. That's great. But at the end of the day, drive more profit, more cash in your pocket is better. Yes, you're going to pay taxes on it, but if you're paying a lot of taxes, it means you're making a lot of money, which is a good thing. So just know that it's a little bit of it's better to have, like you said, no to the long-term earnouts and try to get the cash as soon as possible.
Yes. And I've given that answer to a lot of people that I've had to tell them that they owe X amount of tax, which could be a pretty high number. And I tell them all the time, but that means you made so much money. It never helps. It never helps the conversation in any way. They're still just, oh God, I owe so much money. Oh, why do I owe money? Why can't I owe less? Doesn't help that I tell them they made a good amount of money. But
is there any way to, I mean, I'm just trying to think of, I guess the earnout, yeah, but is there any way of moving the money across 2 years? So that isn't an earnout. Like, can we like buy something big and depreciate it or something, or like something that like, something that makes, because, you know, especially I'm in California, so we have the really high tiered, federal does too. Goes up to tiers up to $500,000 or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And then California also tiers up pretty quick. It's even faster tiered up system than the federal government is. So is there a way that I can just like, on the next exit, we can like kind of cut it in half and move half of it across years?
They can do a payment plan. Like basically, okay, we're going to pay you. We're paying you, but it's not an earnout. It's just we're going to pay you over 2 or 3 years, let's say, just so that you're not paying again all the tax up front.
That's not an earnout. That's like structured debt.
Yeah, exactly. Like a structured payout plan where it's just not an earnout. Just like, hey, I'm going to buy it, but I can pay you 4 installments of X amount of dollars.
You're still taking that risk that they won't pay you in the future.
Correct. That's why, again, going back to why I always say, I want all that money up front. I don't care. You may have a contract and everything like that, but you just never know what might happen to somebody where I don't have the money to pay you anymore.
Have an asset, a collateral on that?
I guess you could. Again, it all comes down to the contract. I mean, just thinking of asset, I always go back to how people can say, like, how can I sell something and not pay any tax on it? And it always makes me think of real estate.
Yes.
You know, just we deal with some real estate here. And one of the tricks or one of the rules about real estate is that you can have a property and you've owned it for, let's say, 3 or 4 years, and it goes up in tremendous value and you want to sell it. But I want to buy another property, this other building over here that I like even better, but I don't want to pay any tax. And you could do that. That's actually one of the few assets where you could say, all right, I don't want this building anymore, but I want that building that's worth more over there. And it's called a 1031 exchange, meaning, hey, I'm going to sell my property, but turn around and buy this property and not have to pay any tax. And yet I can now own another property that's worth a lot more. And a lot of people actually find that very advantageous when they're trying to build a real estate portfolio of some kind. And doing that exchange, really the only downside is, let's say you bought obviously this first building that didn't cost as much more, your basis in that building kind of carries over to the basis in that new, more improved, worth more other building that you liked. And so at some point, whenever you do actually sell that other building, you'll probably owe more tax than you would have.
Can you do that with non-real estate assets?
That is a specific real estate rule.
Why? That's mean. Why not give some special rules for the e-com people?
you would think so. I mean, not to go into politics, but they always say, why do we think Donald Trump hasn't paid tax in the last 20 years? It's because he owned real estate. Trust me, I would guess, and I don't know, he probably didn't pay any taxes in the last 20 years. I'm pretty sure, because there's just so many rules that, you know, give advantages to people who own real estate.
Yeah.
From doing taxes, Andrew, over these amount of years, the most wealthy people I do taxes for own real estate. It's through real estate. That's all there is to it.
I heard someone say, this is, I'm not being mean. I'm just commenting. Mm-hmm. I've heard people say that real estate has the most stupid rich people in it.
Correct. I'm talking about
you. You don't have to be like extremely brilliant to do well in real estate. And that's not a knock against people in real estate. It's just like, it's a knock against the other industries. Like, yeah, why would you want to compete with like Harvard, you know, Stanford grads in the tech companies? Or the Chinese manufacturer, the Chinese factory direct e-com sellers, when they're hard to compete with.
Real estate. They're brilliant. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I will give you that example. There's people that are wealthy out there that make X amount of money or are making great money, but it's the people that are ridiculously wealthy that just have all this money coming out of their ears. They all own real estate. It's because of real estate. So even if I have a client that has this W-2 that are making $700,000, $800,000, $1 million a year, they start investing in real estate because that's the way to get to that next level. If you want to just try to get to that ridiculous amount of wealth, and it's not guaranteed to happen, it has its own risks and stuff like that, and all its shortcomings and pitfalls. You got to have a lot of upfront money to make your down payments and stuff like that. It's the way to get to that ridiculous amount. And just going to down payments, because I got to say this one thing. If you ever want to go into real estate or you're buying your own home, make sure you put 20% down. You have to put 20% down because you don't want to get hit with PMI. That's extra insurance on your mortgage that you'll have to pay to the bank or whatever mortgage lender you have. Don't do that. You'll crush yourself.
When I figured out PMI was, I'm like, oh, it's insurance. Okay, I like insurance. That's good. I have insurance on my car, insurance on my life. You know, like, okay, insurance is good. I'm like, oh, so who's the beneficiary of the insurance policy? Me? They go, mm-mm, the bank is. Oh, okay, who pays? So the bank pays the insurance then? They go, no, you pay it. Wait, what? I have to pay and they get the benefit? That sucks. Yeah. I don't like that.
Yeah, and your monthly mortgage payment might be $800, but now you add the PMI, which could be $400, and it makes your payment that much larger. And that PMI stays there until you've paid down the principal 20% of the value of the building. So you got to keep paying that PMI until you've paid down 20% of that principal. And the hard thing about that is that when you pay off a mortgage, at the beginning of paying off a mortgage, it's all interest. So let's say the first 5 years of paying a mortgage, it's probably 90, 95% interest. So it's going to take you a long time to get your principal down 20% when you borrow money. So again, first rule of investing in real estate or buying a house, please, it's hard to do because that's cash out of the pocket coming up with that money. Try to put 20% down.
So here's two, speaking of interest, here's an idea that I heard. Again, I'm trying to learn more of the like rich people tax stuff. And I'm like, yeah, like, see, you know, obviously a lot of the stuff is like, if you already have $1 million, you can do this. I'm like, well, okay, shit, let me figure out how to get to $1 million first. And then I can start learning those things. Right. But when we do start to get there, there's like these fun rich people things. And I heard this idea, and you tell me if this is legit.
Sure.
I heard the invest, borrow, die strategy.
Yes, 100%. I don't know about the die part because that doesn't make investing any more fun then. So invest, borrow. Okay, this is a great way to increase wealth or build wealth. It's a great way. It's risky, but great. So let's say you go and buy a property that's a rental property, right? And you put your 20% down because you followed Tim's rules. And now you've got your property and you've owned it for 3 or 4 years. You're collecting your rental income, whatever. But again, the property appreciates and you've paid down the mortgage a little bit. You know what I want to do? I want to refinance. Meaning I'm going to take out, let's say the property went from $300,000 to $350,000. But I've also paid the mortgage down from $300,000 to $250,000. So now I've got $100,000 of equity there, right? So I want to refinance for the full value of the property, $350,000. Bank says, sure, no problem. Give you a loan for $350,000. You take $250,000 of it, pay off your own loan. You're left with $100,000. That $100,000 is tax-free. So you can just turn around and buy another property. Invest, borrow. All right, we'll leave the dying part out, but invest, borrow. That besides collecting rental income and hopefully making a lot of money and buying another property, a very, very popular way of investing in more properties is to invest, refinance, and buy another property with that refinancing money. Again, you've got to have a property that appreciates. You know, you've got obviously a tenant of some kind, and you're paying it down. But it works, and it's very popular because it's tax free. It's tax free money.
I don't feel like I want to talk about dying. So, that's the when do you have to pay the loan off? Because you're borrowing and then you pay it over 30 years. But if you're reborrowing every 10 years, then when is it that you pay the loan off? And the answer is your estate pays it off in 150 years from now. When you die, your estate pays it off.
150
and,
years.
And that's you said earlier, the 1031 exchange. If you know, the basis, whatever, we don't get super complicated because
sure.
It's hard. Yeah. It's hard. We're not looking at spreadsheets on YouTube and podcasts, right? But in general, you would have to, if you sold an asset and then like said, oh, I profited a bunch, then the government wants to tax you a bunch, right? But if you 1031 exchange it, you get to go into a bigger building, but then you would have to pay extra taxes later.
Right.
But then you say, well, when later comes, you just go and buy another bigger.
Absolutely.
Building, and you go, well, when do I pay it? Well, then eventually you die and you pass on this real estate to your heirs and they have a new stepped up basis and you never pay the taxes.
That could possibly be true. And moreover, you've put those properties in a trust, more importantly. That's definitely something you would want to do.
Oh, and the trust doesn't die.
Right. But it also keeps the assets in your, as we call it, your bloodline. Now we're going into estate planning, and not to do that, more important. But let's say, Andrew, we want to make sure that your kids have these properties that you're investing in. Always stay with your kids and then their kids. So if you form a trust and put those properties in the trust and make your kids beneficiaries, great. They're going to benefit from them. But let's say those kids get married. And not to, again, we're talking about dying. We're going to talk about some negative things. And they get divorced. You don't want this other person to have any claim on those assets at all. Having them in a trust means that your child doesn't own them, you know, themselves. So even in a divorce, nobody can get their hands on that property. It's in a trust. Only it'll always be your children's, and then their children's and children's, you know, depending on how long the trust goes for.
Can you borrow against a trust?
Sure. You refinance the property and stuff like that. And, you know, it all depends on what's in the trust instrument, on how much money you can take out, what you can do. It's all the language you can put in there to protect the principal, which is for here, it's the property, so that nobody just sells the property and takes all the money out. You can all put those rules in so that, hey, you only can take out 2% or 3% of the earnings and maybe, or all the earnings and only 2% or 3% of a principal each year. And that helps protect the assets for future generations.
That is cool.
Not to go into investing and stuff, but you know, hey, listen, we want properties that grow and more properties so that each generation has more and more wealth going down the line and never pay off the mortgage.
I love it. I love it. So I kind of asked a few questions. Are there any I call them rich people tax loopholes, right? Are there any extra rich people things that you can think of? You're like, oh yeah, once people kind of get to that, like, I don't know, $500,000 income, net worth of like multiple millions, maybe not the 100 million people, right? But I think everyone who's listening is aspiring to be that multimillionaire. Are there any other like, oh yeah, everyone does this cool tax thingy when they get to this level?
Yeah, I'll give you one example. Just because I do have a few of those clients and we're talking multiple millions, $5 million, you know, $6 million. What do these people do with their money? Because it's so tax advantageous is they invest in state municipal bonds, all of them. They're triple tax free, meaning, all right, I'm in New York State, right outside Manhattan. I'm going to buy the New York State something bond, which means it's federal tax free and state tax free. It's a lower interest rate, meaning, hey, normal bonds out there will pay higher interest, so you'll make more money. But I want these are risk-free, guaranteed by the government bonds. They're lower interest, but you're not paying any tax on them. So you've got those $3, $4 million. You buy $3 or $4 million worth of bonds. You may have interest of $60,000, $70,000 a year that you don't have to pay tax on. They all do that. all of them. Just pay, because the government's never going to not pay its debt. It never is, it's never defaulted on its debt ever. That's why we keep having increased debt in the national debt, because we always pay our debts. So taking
invest,
state
borrow,
run,
die. But yep. I guess
it's countries die,
hopefully never yeah. die.
Yeah, I agreed. But that is definitely one of the secrets, let's say, that the next level wealthy people absolutely do. They're just buying these municipal bonds and just earning the interest tax free.
Nice. What's the yield on a municipal bond? Aren't they like 2% or something?
Yeah, it's lower. But if you're talking about an investment of $3-4 million, you could make some enough interest to really make some money. And you know, yeah, maybe that's smaller return, but again, no risk. So that's what what I see they all do.
Nice. I love that. Cool. Yeah. Any Thanks. More rich people tax loophole things?
No, it was real estate would have been the next thing. They all invest in real estate. I don't care how wealthy they are. They will continue to invest in real estate. They will just keep buying real estate. You know, interesting thing. I have this one person who actually buys real estate debt. So I don't know if people knew this, is that if this was in the housing crisis of 2009, stuff like that. But still today, that anyone can, let's say I don't pay my real estate taxes on my property. Anyone can go pay those real estate taxes for me at a government agency. I don't know this, but if you don't pay your real estate taxes, the government can charge you interest. And I think that interest is up to 18%. Yeah, but that's to the government. And so somebody can come buy that debt. You, the person who owns the house, doesn't know that I own the debt, because you're going to still pay the real estate taxes plus interest to the government, and the government will just turn around and give it to me because I bought the debt. I get that 18% interest. And so, wow, I'm earning 18% on my money. Possible downside to that is somebody doesn't pay their real estate taxes and you've got to foreclose on their property, but still, neither here nor there, just thinking of real estate and different types of investments.
So you would be like, okay, interesting. So you'd be like, tax collector position. You're like a private tax collector.
Right. But you don't have to bill. You don't have to calculate interest. The government continues to do that for you.
Interesting.
It's just those interesting cool. stuff. Yeah. It's so cool.
Cool ideas.
Yeah. I mean, I'm awesome. Sure you have you obviously have to invest a lot of money because you got to buy up all this debt and stuff like that, but it's just interesting.
Very cool. All right, Tim, that was so good. Lots of good stuff there. Lots of, we'll call it rich people taxes there. So that's good. Love it. Excited. Everyone listening to this, you will, if you can't use this rich people tax advice right now, I guarantee you will, because people who listen to the Zoncom podcast will eventually be multimillionaires. So guys, thanks so much for listening to that. Tim, we love asking everybody the same three questions. We didn't ask it last episode because I was waiting for this episode. So the first question I like to ask people is why? So when we are in this entrepreneurial journey, we do it for a special reason. And my favorite letter in the alphabet is why. Why do we do these things? So I'm curious, you are a e-commerce accountant. Why do e-commerce? Why not plumbing or real estate or whatever else? Why are you in this space?
Yep. I've been doing this been an accountant for 23 years, and I was doing and still do plumbing and real estate and lawyers and doctors and stuff like that. But I had one seller who was selling on her own website and I was doing her taxes, but then started trying this thing out called Amazon. I'm talking about 10 years ago. And just kept coming to me with questions. What's Nexus? And why do I have to pay sales tax here? And how do you read the Amazon settlement report and stuff like that? And I didn't know the answer at the time, but client asks me a question. I do the research and I think I figured it out here, figured it out there, this, that, and the other thing. And then she just came to me and said, by the way, I have 2,000 other people who have the exact same questions and can't find an accountant that understands anything or can give them a straight answer on any of their questions. So got involved in the community, went to a Prosper show, went to a couple other shows, and next thing you know, I have clients galore that they're just desperate for help. They just need good tax advice. They want to just focus on selling and not being able to get a straight answer on some really good complex tax questions, because being an e-commerce seller can be a little complex, you know, with the inventory moving around and Nexus and stuff like that. But finally being able to give these people a straight answer, just, oh my, the relief on their face, just like, okay, good. Oh, it's been stressful because I can't get an answer from people on all these tax questions and bookkeeping and how does Amazon do this and that. You know, it was satisfying because, you know, I want my clients to make money and I want them to pay the right amount of tax, not too much tax. It's really satisfying, and it's a good why reason on why I do it. It's just really to give these people their answers and to let them be an entrepreneur and hopefully grow their business for, you know, a possible exit or whatever someday.
Nice. I love it. I will say I used a non-e-commerce accountant before. Well, first of all, I just did a shitty spreadsheet and it was painful. And I cried every single time, every single April, because I was like, oh, my God, I had to like pull. Oh, it was so hard. And then I was like, but I'm smart. I have like a math degree. I can do this. And then I was like, oh, my God, bookkeeping and taxes are not the same skill set as whatever my math degree was. And it was painful. And then I got a bookkeeper. But that bookkeeper was like specialized in restaurants or something. They're just like 4.9 stars on Yelp down the street from me. And I was really excited and it really sucked. And then finally, when I got into the e-commerce accounting, it was golden. So yes, I thank you. I'm going to say thank you from all of our community to you for doing the e-com stuff.
I appreciate it. Yeah, it could be brutal. We do get quite a few clients that were using somebody else and it's just not their field. So, you know, they'll come to us and just straighten them out, or the amount of time it takes them to put that spreadsheet together hopefully February, but generally it's usually like right before tax day. And like, here it is. Hopefully it makes sense to you.
April 14th. You know, everyone knows they do their taxes April 14th because they're doing
correct, the 15th. Right. It's amazing how much that's the most popular day everyone does their taxes. But, you know, the time spent on putting that together and doing the research and getting all your numbers together, which can be spent doing so many more other productive things, you know, to improve your business, source inventory, stuff like that. Hopefully, just the investment in a good e-commerce accountant just saves you money on that so that you're not spending your time, which is the most valuable thing to, I think, an e-commerce seller, because you're wearing so many hats, you're marketing, you're sourcing, you're doing so many different things that hopefully, you know, a knowledgeable e-commerce accountant is worth the investment.
Absolutely. What is a favorite piece of media or something, some way that you gain your information about this space that you can share with the audience?
Favorite piece of media? You know what? I don't think I would call it media. My favorite piece of or source to get all my information, especially for people who sell on e-commerce, are the sellers themselves. I'm constantly talking to different sellers and always learning. I mean, I think everybody realizes that the space is constantly evolving. It's constantly changing. And talking to different sellers all the time, you know, I'm learning about things that, oh, guess what? This just changed or that just changed. You know, it was one of the big reasons how I got into the field, going to different conferences, just talking to people face to face at, let's say, whatever booth we have set up, and listening to what challenges they're having or what tax, you know, nuances they're going through is the best way I find to learn about what's going on in any platform's world, from, let's say, a foreign seller selling into the US and now needing insurance on their products and stuff like that, to whether, you know, how I can deduct this, that, or the other thing, and my business is growing and what's estimate taxes and how do I pay the right amount in, and, you know, everything that most people go through. And you know, just talking to people as opposed to maybe reading a magazine or this article, I just find is the best source of knowledge to keep up to date with sellers who sell here in the United States or are selling, again, outside of the country on different marketplaces.
Nice. Networking. That's I highly suggest. I love that. Also, I love books and podcasts. Really, one of the best ways to learn is to go to conferences, sit with that random person, like have a coffee, have lunch, meet that friend of a friend and like learn their story and stuff. And that's actually where this podcast came from, was the Amazon Conversations podcast. I would go to conferences and have these conversations with people. I'm like, oh my God, I learned so much from this one person. And I wish I could like capture this content, capture this conversation and like share it with other people. And that's where the podcast came from. So that I fully endorse that. And, you know, actually, if you are looking for a network of sellers, I am a coach leader inside the Titan Network, which is a network and mastermind for Amazon sellers. And we have people all the way from kind of the very beginning of their journey. You do have to sell on Amazon already. You have to like to get in. You have to. It's not really like a training course, but if you already have a product on Amazon, Or if you're growing up to that multi seven figure exit, we have lots of people who are doing as much as 8 figures in sales, and some people even approaching 9 figures in sales. So if you are interested in that, there is a link to check out the Titan Network in the show notes. So Tim, the last thing I like to ask everybody, what is one actionable thing that Amazon sellers can do today?
I think one of the actionable things they can do, which is, I think, a very new hot topic and hot item for a lot of sellers, is how much money can I get for my business? What is my business worth? What can I sell it for? There are so many aggregators out there now that are just raising money and looking to buy different brands and different businesses that people are so, sellers are so focused on selling and making money, which is great. But at some point, you know, do they realize how much they can sell their company for? So Avask definitely has a mergers and acquisitions department, and we have relationships with a lot, many of the biggest aggregators and just a lot of different aggregators. And so what we do is for free, we will just quickly take a look at their financials, kind of give them an idea of what we think they can get for their company. Then if it's something that they like, obviously represent them moving forward to put their company in front of as many aggregators as possible and hopefully get the most money out of their company. It's amazing how many, a couple of clients that I've spoken to recently just, you know, they just don't realize like, wow, I could sell my company for this amount of money, because they're very happy with how much money they're making with their business. But, you know, you put a multiple on that on what's going on right now, let's say 4, 5, 3, whatever it is, that's very attractive to a lot of people. And, you know, just knowing that, on top of, as we were talking about before, knowing your numbers is one thing, but hey, even knowing that is another thing. And there's a lot of hungry aggregators out there that are looking to buy as quickly as possible good selling businesses. And you know, those closings with those aggregators can, you know, take a month, maybe, you know, not nothing crazy too long, you know, depending on who you're dealing with. But, you know, having good organized financials, and, you know, we find that the clients that we represent, the aggregators know us, so they know they're getting trusted financials. Those aggregators are the ones that are laying out the money. But, you know, giving them trusted financials to hopefully ensure a quick, smooth sale is good. And so kind of getting an idea of what your business might be worth is something worth looking into.
Nice. And where do they go to get that that evaluation?
So they can just contact myself here at Avask, and we'll get them set up right away. Whether we're doing the books for you or you're doing books yourselves, we just need a set of financials, and we can just start the conversation. And really what we can do is, A, first give you a general idea of what the valuation is. But again, if you want to move forward after that to look to sell your company, we will go through your financials thoroughly and give you a good idea of what it's worth and little improvements here or there, so that once they're presented to aggregators, they don't have anything to nitpick. They just say, oh, okay, here it is, and make their offer. And again, there's no commitment needed on your end. Any amount of money that an aggregator offered, you can just say no thanks, and we move on.
Nice. And what's the email and contact information should they use to get a hold of you guys?
Sure. Anyone can, I'd rather have them reach out to myself. My email address is timothy.nelson@avaskgroup.com, or call our office here in New York at 914-664-1900.
Nice. Awesome. Yay. Tim, thank you so much. We talked about all sorts of fun stuff. We talked about rich people taxes, how to do, the billable babies. It's a maybe. The R&D tax credit, that's a maybe. The different ways to optimize our taxes, the stock versus asset sale payouts and earnouts, whether we should do that or not. And of course, a little bit of fun stuff about real estate and the invest, borrow, die concepts and the municipal bonds. So Tim, thank you so much. This is a great, great episode, and happy to have you, and thanks so much.
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Hey guys, if you found value from this episode, I would love if you could tell the world. And if you don't want to tell the entire world, I would love for you to tell iTunes at least. If you can go to iTunes, if you listen to this podcast on iTunes, go ahead and go leave us a review. I have a few here that are amazing that I love to read out. I read every single review that's posted. This one is a review from Amber K. If you're looking for a podcast to efficiently learn hacks to grow your Amazon business, Excellence, this is it. Andrew's wealth of knowledge is abundant and generously shares it all for this podcast. The latest and greatest information to push to your business to the right, to the next level is right here. Stop reading this review and tap play. Nice. Oh, I love it, Amber K. Thank you so much for doing that. So if you think you have a review that is equal or better than Amber K's, or worse, whatever. If you don't like me, that's cool. You can tell me too, whatever. Go to iTunes, leave a review. Also, Spotify now is allowing ratings. So please go onto Spotify and super easy. You don't even have to write anything. You just hit 5 stars and leave that review. You know, as an Amazon seller, how important reviews are to your business. I am asking you, at the goodness of your heart, please leave me a review as well. Thanks.